Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Mads.
Hello, start of the week, and this is MoneyWeb at Midday. Whether you're tuning in live or listening to the podcast, please join me, Jeremy Mags, as I explore the issues and ideas shaping our world with key thinkers and decision makers. So let's get started, sharp, relevant, and straight to the heart of the story. Coming up in the next 30 minutes, as the world readies for Donald Trump's inauguration, I'll talk to an expert on economic and trade impact. A new study shows the crippling effect of late payments on South Africa's small business sector, why e-invoicing has benefits beyond tax compliance, and is there still space for brick and mortar shops in a world that is increasingly moving online? It's Monday, January the 20th. With Donald Trump's inauguration taking place later today, the world is obviously watching closely to see how his policies are going to shape global markets. And South Africa is no exception. Like many emerging economies, we could feel the effects of his stance on trade, tariffs and investment. And will his America First approach create challenges or perhaps even opportunities for our economy? I'm joined now by Professor André Roux, economist at the Stellenbosch Business School. Professor, a very warm welcome to you. So we know that the America First policy focuses on protectionism. How might this impact on South Africa's trade relations with the US?
Yes, thanks. Hi, Jeremy, and welcome to all your listeners. Yes, that's certainly been one of his mantras, protectionism, tariffs, protecting America from what he once called the ravages of foreign competition. I think we need to bear in mind, before I answer your question directly, that Donald Trump has come into power on a high. He won the election resoundingly, obviously. He has a majority as party in both the Senate and the House of Representatives. And the economy of America is not a bad condition at the moment. The GDP is back to pre-COVID levels, low unemployment, falling inflation. So he's on a high, and he's already, suggested making 200 presidential executive orders within the next few days, if not hours. Mm. And foremost amongst these are bound to be some announcement regarding tariffs. Now, we know that his biggest concern, of course, is China, but he has also threatened to impose tariffs on a whole range of countries. The level we'll find out hopefully soon. Now, you've got to see this question in conjunction with AGOA, the African Growth and Opportunity Act, which is all about America providing special treatment, if you like, to selected African countries, and reducing or eliminating tariffs. But to qualify, you need to be in America's good books. And there's always a risk that South Africa, you know, what's an old saying which I'll paraphrase or twist, that my enemy's friend is my enemy. So if America and Trump start seeing South Africa as being a friend of the likes of China and Russia and anti-Israel, they might very well turn around and say, well, in that case, South Africa, you no longer qualify for a AGOA. So it could be a double whammy. So the bottom line is, I think we, like many most other countries, might see our export performance coming under pressure.
Professor, we do know broadly that Africa and obviously South Africa is low on Washington's agenda, certainly as far as Donald Trump is concerned. So let's assume that he does enforce stricter trade deals. Where would it leave exports, particularly in critical sectors like mining, agriculture, and what is left of manufacturing in this country?
Yeah, well, fortunately, we're not as dependent on trade with America as we were maybe 20 years ago, but they're still amongst, you know, our top export destinations. It will have an effect. And you're quite right. I don't think Africa's front and center in his thoughts, but we could sort of be collateral damage. You know, if you start seeing a fully blown trade war between China and America, so we could be collateral damage, get caught in the crossfire. And it wouldn't bother him too much because, as you quite rightly point out, by all accounts, he's not all that concerned about Africa. It's not a big deal for him. But there are other issues that might also, perhaps indirectly, have an impact on our economy. Things such as what he's going to do. He's promised to stop the war in Ukraine. He will boast that he's brought about a ceasefire in the Middle East, at least for the time being. But if he withdraws support for Ukraine, which is being suggested, and leaves that over to Western Europe, that's a further disturbance to global dynamics. The Global Risk Report came out a couple of days ago, and it says that the biggest single risk facing the world right now is state-based armed conflict, and the third biggest is geo-economic confrontation. And again, we will be collateral damage in that. It can't be good for us. So add to that his view or stance on the environment. He wants to wipe away environmental regulation. He wants to unleash the American energy sources. He supports fracking. He's going to postpone, he says, incentives to buy electric vehicles. Again, this could in the long term be detrimental, of course, to the entire world, including South Africa.
Professor, we all know that investment is about sentiment and optics. We also know the global economy is facing a lot of uncertainty. So the policies that you've just outlined, surely there would be a potential knock-on effect in terms of investor confidence, not only in South Africa, but the broader region.
Yes, absolutely. And in fact, the broader world, for that matter. And I think we might find that initially, at least, the markets will welcome Donald Trump's, let's say, policies. I mean, he's come into power based on things such as obviously protecting America comes first, call it what you like, making America great. And people like his stance. He's a maverick. He's an anti-establishmentarianism, if you like. And people admire that. He has lots of support. He's anti-wokeness. He's lots of support amongst ordinary people across the planet. And I mean, by reversing the ban on TikTok, he's also probably garnered a bit more support. He has vowed to end DEI in the federal government in America, diversity, equity, and inclusion. So he's popular. He's pro the ordinary man and woman. And yet, ironically, he's surrounded by multi-billionaires. But that's the nature of the man. So I think in the short term, we might see American economy doing quite well, but the effect on the world economy, I suspect, will be more negative than positive. Just bear one last thing in mind. You know, the stance on immigrants, or he wants to get rid of all those hundreds of thousands of immigrants, that will raise the cost of labor in America and bring with it a bit of inflation. If at the same time he raises tariffs that raise the cost of imports, also raising inflation. So it could be that the slowdown in inflation might be curbed, which means that the drop in interest rates in America might be postponed or curbed, which actually means a firmer dollar, which by implication means a weaker rand, unless we also, in reaction, slow down the deceleration in interest rates. So there's another potential impact.
So, Professor, in conclusion then, looking ahead, is there anything that businesses and policymakers in South Africa should be doing in the immediate term to prepare for this new Trump era of volatility?
I suspect that it's already been, as I say, discounted into people's decision making. If we talk about policymakers at a political level, one would like to see them a bit of détente, as it were, as perhaps in our favor. That, as you know, obviously we chair the G20 this year. Hopefully that will give us a kind of entry into those upper circles and try to influence people and people in minds. But really, I think we, as always, you know, there's an old saying that says if America catches a cold, the rest of the world gets flu and some get pneumonia. I'm afraid that still holds true to a large extent. Being such a small player in the big picture, there's not much we can do. And I think as long as we have, on the positive side, the government of national unity is deemed by the market to be more, if you like, market-related. And that's a positive thing in anybody's books.
Professor André Roux, economist at Stellenbosch Business School, as always, thank you very much for your insights.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, this is a problem that I think affects many small companies in South Africa. Late payments often cripple small businesses, with cash flow challenges forcing many then to downsize, delay payments to suppliers, or worst case scenario, shut their doors entirely. There's a new study that highlights the scale of this problem and its devastating impact on the country's economic backbone, small and medium enterprises in particular. So let's discuss the issue. How bad is it? And perhaps more importantly, potential solutions and strategic approaches. I'm joined by Colin Timmis, who is country manager at Xero South Africa. Colin, welcome and thank you very much indeed. The current scale then of late payments for small businesses in this country, how bad is it? And do you think it's getting worse?
Yes, it's a massive problem, Jeremy. Small businesses are doing all the work and all the services, providing the products to their clients. And once you've provided a lot of those, you need to make your profit. But of course, you can't make your profit unless people pay you. And so getting those funds into their bank accounts is a critical part of that process of realizing that profit. And it seems to be a growing problem. We've been doing this study for a number of years, looking at the state of small business in South Africa and cash flow, managing accounts receivable, managing debtors, however you like to call them, is still a major problem for small businesses. And there's a number of ways that these small businesses can solve these challenges. And we are seeing some of this take hold in the industry, but it still remains a massive problem and something they really need to focus on.
Let's talk about the solve in just a moment. But the tragedy, I think, in a situation like this is often those small enterprises are afraid to challenge the bigger organization for fear of losing future work.
Yes, 100%. And there is definitely a great onus on larger companies, on governments doing business with smaller businesses to show them that respect for their services. Because, of course, there is that fear. You know, if you push too hard, what happens to your contract? What happens to your invoices? And so there is a bit of a burden on larger companies to treat these small businesses with a bit more respect, to show them that we value their products and services. And that means paying them on time. When the service is delivered, they don't have the facilities, they don't have the mechanisms that larger companies have, and so we really do need to make sure that once an invoice is received, that it is paid within the desired payment terms.
Colin, is it just inefficiency within a bigger organization that causes the delay, or are there other reasons for letting smaller businesses twist on a string?
Look, I think there are some inefficiencies that cause the delay, but to be honest, sometimes these challenges are actually the result of a lack of financial controls and systems inside the small business. Larger businesses, while sometimes inefficient, do have processes that have to be followed, and so they have to have documentation provided in specific formats. You know, your invoice has got to be prepared professionally and contain all of your information before it's enabled to be paid. You've also got to follow up some times. You know, you can't just issue an invoice and not do the following up yourself. And I think a lot of the time small businesses don't pay the right amount of attention to how they issue invoices and what their actual debt collection processes are. And sometimes companies do just take a chance. They just pay the people that are screaming the loudest. And sometimes things do just fall through the cracks. So while there is that responsibility on larger businesses, I'd probably say at the same time, there is a bit of a burden on smaller companies to make sure that they are running their financial affairs in a responsible manner that makes it easy for people to pay them. And that means just having these financial systems in place.
So Colin, are there specific tools or strategies then that SMEs need to deploy to better manage cash flow and then mitigate the risks associated with late payments, as you've outlined to me?
Yeah, look, there's probably two things. One, have a proper financial information system that enables you to issue your invoices and track what happens with the invoice. Software nowadays enables you to not just send an invoice, but you can actually see when somebody has opened the invoice. So if I send you an invoice this afternoon, I know that you've opened it and that you've viewed it. Now, the way that I follow up with you for payment is going to be very different as opposed to another customer who maybe hasn't opened that invoice yet. And so using tools that are, using the latest digital technologies enable you to do that, enables you to refine your debt collection process, and enables you to collect your money a lot quicker. That's probably number one. Find those tools that enable you to have those insights and that level of professionalism. Number two, give your clients options to pay you. You know, being paid cash, being paid by EFT, being paid by credit card are some of the methods that you can collect payments. But why not use an invoicing system that enables your customers to have that choice? If you're on site at a customer, why leave the customer before they've paid you? There are a lot of services where you can deploy credit card and online payment mechanisms directly on your phone while you're even at the customer. That again enables them to pay you immediately rather than having to follow up on those invoices in the days or weeks after the actual service.
It's a very good point that you make, but again, it comes back to having the wherewithal and the courage to do it.
Yeah, it does. But, you know, we live in an age where most of these things that I'm speaking about are available on your mobile phone. You know, there are apps and products that are relatively easy to work with and use, minimal costs. And when it comes to cost as well for some of these tools, I just encourage people to think about the opportunity cost that comes from spending time trying to collect money when business owners should be focused on growing and managing their company. Instead, they're spending their time on debt collection. That's what we call opportunity cost, the cost of lost work done elsewhere. And then, of course, think about the cost of interest and on the debt that you're paying to finance your debtors. So there are some costs for these services, but honestly, it is it's immaterial when you consider the size of the problem that most small businesses have when it comes to cash flow and how it distracts a company and ultimately cripples it.
And let me add one more to that list. The more time, I guess, you spend chasing debt, it's going to stifle innovation within the company and your ability to grow and progress.
Yeah, absolutely. Again, as the business owner, whether it's you or whether it's your staff or your team, you're not focused on the things that are helping you be productive and efficient. And the other element as well, just to throw another one in, is the damaging relationships that result from having to continuously follow up on a payment. You know, if you're got somebody who owes you money and you're constantly hounding them, it damages the long-term prospects with that customer. So getting these systems set up, unfortunately, a lot of the time, you know, financial systems and debt collection are associated with accounting, which is not something that people are that passionate or interested in. But a lot of the new modern tools are really built for small businesses, enable them to use this level of functionality for what they need, while their accountant can do the sort of boring stuff in the background. But this is one element, cash flow, money management, that is absolutely critical. And I really encourage, you know, small businesses to make sure that they're set up and doing it in the most efficient way.
And not that difficult to do. Is the argument that smaller businesses will talk about the cost of the outlay in terms of the software and then difficulty in understanding it. But I think what you're telling me is that that is easily overcome.
Yeah, it's changed. It's not what it used to be, you know, 10, 15, 20 years ago. When I started out in the accounting industry, as an example, you know, people came to me because they had no interest in doing accounting, and debt collection invoicing was sort of an element of accounting. So they would abdicate that responsibility to someone like myself. That's completely changed now. The software has evolved to the point where it is engaging for a small business owner. It helps that small business owner understand what's going on in their company. And it's got, you know, it's extremely powerful accounting features, a lot of these tools, but the business owner is not intimidated by the user experience or the user interface. It's very inviting, uses simple terminology and language, and that's what business owners should be looking for.
Good advice as the business year begins. Colin Timmis, I'm going to leave it there. Country Manager Zero South Africa, I do appreciate your time.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
I want to give you a little practical business advice now to start the year, and imagine transforming your business operations while saving time, cutting costs, and also boosting financial security. Well, that's exactly what e-invoicing is promising to deliver. And here's an interesting statistic. Global e-invoicing, the market that is set to soar by $45 billion US dollars by 2028. So obviously this isn't a passing trend. So here in South Africa, what is the situation? Well, the shift is gaining momentum, I'm told, and businesses that act now are going to reap the rewards long before compliance with SARS's VAT modernization program becomes mandatory. So let's take a look at the potential of e-invoicing. Shannon Friedman is with us, Chief Executive Officer at VAT Modernization South Africa, a leading advocate for digital transformation in the financial space. So let's start with the basics, Shannon. Welcome to you. What exactly is e-invoicing, and how does it differ from what we know, the traditional methodology?
Thanks, Jeremy. So let's compare how e-invoicing stacks up to how businesses invoice today. So majority of businesses today will send out their invoices. They'll get them in a PDF format, usually from their accounting system or the ERP, and then send that to their customers over email. Now, that's obviously a great advancement to what used to be done, where people were sending invoices physically or over the post, but it doesn't come without its hang-ups and disadvantages. For that, you've got to understand, so when people get these invoices, it's quite slow and it's quite manual when they have to enter those in into their accounting systems and their ERP systems. The reason for that is most often how these invoices are processed is by human and by eye. Someone physically receives those invoices over mail and actually enters the underlying data into their systems. You do have some businesses, however, who are adopting technologies like optical character recognition and OCR. But with those as well, they also tend to be quite slow and also highly error prone. The reason for that is while computers are very good at processing files and documents that are in a structured data format, so things like your XMLs, Excel spreadsheets, CSVs, when it comes to visual file formats, and PDFs would be an example of a visual file format, they tend to have a much more difficult time just because a computer doesn't necessarily think like that when it comes to processing data. And that's where something like e-invoicing comes in. Rather than sending a visual document format, this would be supplemented by sending to your customers your documents in a structured data format. And that not only does it get sent by email, but it actually gets sent directly from businesses' accounting systems to the recipient accounting system. So you don't have either any of that risk of the documents getting misplaced, they're getting lost before they get entered into the final destination. In addition to that, because the documents are in a structured data format, that's something that computers love to deal with. They're very fast at processing such files, and they're very accurate at processing such files because they're very good at processing high quantities of structured information.
Now, you point out two specific advantages here. One is as much as a 60% cost saving, and the second of all, it would improve financial security.
Correct. So when it comes to e-invoicing, due to all the efficiency benefits that it has, all those processes that leverage off invoices and business documentation, such as accounts receivable processes, your accounts payable processes, even processes when it comes to obtaining funds from financial institutions and banks and stuff, those processes can be conducted significantly much more effectively just due to the fact that you've got your data being processed so much faster. You know, traditionally businesses, when they're dealing with financial data and they're looking at their financial data, there's often a lag at which they're looking at it. They're often looking at historical information, information that's typically about 1 month old. But when you're dealing with something like e-invoicing that can process such quantities of information basically instantaneously, it allows businesses to have a much more real-time view of what's actually going on with their transactions, and allows them to also complete a lot of the processes and workflows associated with those processes so much more efficiently. And as a result, downstream, they have benefits like enhanced cash flow, faster collections, they're able to pay their suppliers a lot quicker and get access to financing as well.
So what then are some of the common misconceptions or fears that businesses have about making the transition, and how would they address them?
Look, I think when there's always a change or a transition that's imminent for businesses, there's often always the fear that that change is going to come with certain costs involved, as well as, you know, a lot of time and resources maybe being taken up due to the fact that you've got to make those transitions and accommodations. I think when it comes to something like e-invoicing, it really all comes down to how businesses approach this transition. We would really recommend that businesses look at solutions and consider solutions that integrate directly with their ERP systems. So for example, we work with a technology partner such as System1A, which integrates directly with businesses' ERP systems, which essentially allows them to not only conduct their business as per normal, as they're used to their current systems, but also the whole underlying e-invoicing process happens automatically for them. You minimize the learning curve and you also minimize the cost of that implementation. Mm. The thing that businesses want to really avoid is implementing a solution that requires an overhaul of the existing systems that they have in place, because that's when things can get extremely costly.
Shannon, I'm going to leave it there with my thanks. Shannon Friedman is the Chief Executive Officer of VAT Modernization South Africa. I do appreciate your time today.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, e-commerce in South Africa is seeing tremendous growth, but many companies are also having to find innovative or new ways to balance the convenience of online shopping, and we all know how convenient it is, with the need for physical touch points. Tactility is important. Now, you'll know the brand Home Choice. It's a household name in retail, and it's got interesting plans to expand its physical store footprint to complement its e-commerce platform. And I want to talk now to Chris De Wit, who's Chief Executive Officer of Home Choice, to discuss this retail hybrid strategy. Chris, a very warm welcome to you. Conventional wisdom would suggest the other way, that the future is fully online, yet you have a different view. What's driving that thinking?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. Thanks for the time. You know, I think what we've seen is that our customers still have a need to interact with our brand and interact with our product. And our product is quite an emotive product. We do textiles and bedding. And what we've seen is that our customers would like to touch the product, feel the product, and engage with it. And then sometimes they make the decision to buy in the store or to go buy online or even maybe, you know, through a catalog. So it's really looking at the customer needs and kind of filling that. And also what we've seen post-COVID is customers returning back to that mall kind of experience. You know, they go out for an outing, they go out and have something to eat. It's quite aspirational in some areas. So, you know, that's the kind of approach.
Chris, I do understand the tactility, and particularly when it comes to an item like you're selling bedding. Do you think that model is starting to apply to lots of other sectors within the retail trade, people hankering after that return to what they are familiar with?
Yeah, I think certainly, you know, there's a need, I think, from customers to engage with another person on the other side and also maybe to experiment with things. So, you know, what we've seen is, I'm going to use an example like mobile phones. Even in that, you know, customers like to speak about the different specs, and then maybe you browse with them on the tablet in the store, and they still got that need. And definitely, it's also still seen as an aspirational thing. You know, our customer base is mass middle market. It's an urban black woman. And they definitely still want that engagement with the brand and us.
Chris, having said that, though, it's important that the way in which stores are constructed these days are very different to perhaps 5-10 years ago. Critical to complement your digital offering with the physical stores. How do you set about that? Is there a redesign component? Is there a new way of layout? What's the strategic thinking there?
Yeah, absolutely. So what we've definitely done is we've made our showrooms much smaller. You know, so our ideal now is 250 square meters. It's not as big as it was in the past, and it's combining the digital experience with the physical experience. So, you know, they can browse online. There's opportunity for them to go onto WhatsApp. So definitely it is smaller, and you don't carry as much stock, which also helps on working capital.
What's happened to the old-fashioned salesperson in all of this? Do they still have a role?
Yes, you know, I think they've become more like, you know, we call them concierge or our interior decorators for our customers. So they don't only play one role, they play more than one role. And also they are there to service the customer, to play a customer experience, and also to convey the brand. And at Home Choice, you know, we want to convey a very certain brand. There's a certain feel in the showroom. Some of our customers, when they come back, they ask for the specific sales associate on their name. So it's creating that closer kind of connection with the customer. And that's been our kind of approach with these new smaller showrooms.
I understand that, and I absolutely acknowledge the interface between the physicality and the online. But a lot of people that you might be dealing with would still be intimidated by the digital component. How do you enable people to overcome that fear, or is it simply up to them? Have they just got to get over it themselves?
Yeah, so I'm going to give you an example. You know, we did a trip end of last year up into Soweto, and we've got quite a few showrooms up there. And some of the I'll call it the older customers, you've got to educate them. So you've got to sit there, you've got to help them with their phone and WhatsApp, and say you can now ask for a balance, you can browse a product, you can see your specials. And when they kind of overcome that, they are comfortable to use that. But for them just doing it out of their own, we've definitely seen a barrier. So there's, from our side, it's partnering with the customers and making them comfortable to make that transition.
I don't need to tell you, Chris, that the retail market in South Africa is very competitive, and I'm going to get a view from you in just a moment on how you see 2025 playing out. But the hybrid strategy that you're referring to now, that you're implementing, how does this differ a brand like Home Choice differently from its competitors? Because I'm going to assume that you're not the only organization that is embarking on this duality.
Yeah, I think for us, it's, you know, one of the things that we had to do is go back and focus on our heritage product. So I think about 2-3 years ago, we probably widened it too much. And for us, it's really focusing on the quality of our bedding and making sure the customer understands that, and creating, I would say, more superior and closer relationship with the customer. Yes, you know, things are competitive and things are challenging out there. But it's kind of sticking to our knitting. And this is one of the strategies where we are taking the brand and the product to the customer and getting it out there. You know, we have ambitions to go to about 60 in the next 12 to 18 months, and then we want to be at 100, you know, by the end of 2026 into 2027. So we want to be there where our customer is.
Chris, what's the secret in choosing a new duvet or a new set of sheets? How does one go about doing it?
Well, you know, for us, I'm a bit biased because we do have the best blankets.
Well, of course you are, but there's what's the general approach?
Yeah, but you know, the big thing, I'm going to use a blanket as an example. It's the thread count and the feeling, and you know, we go up to 3-ply. It is a luxurious silky feel, and maybe I can send you one, and you can touch and feel it. But it's about the thread count and the quality, and that's really what sets us apart from our customers. We have the best blankets in South Africa.
Well, there you got the plug in, Chris. Final question for you. The retail sector generally in South Africa in 2025, it faced a tough year last year. Are you more optimistic about the next 12 months?
Yeah, I think we're definitely feeling more optimistic. You know, our customers, they don't necessarily feel the interest rate reductions, which maybe the bigger mortgages or vehicle finance field, but certainly they are sensitive to inflation. And there, you know, we are expecting some good things for this year, and we are expecting some relief, and we can already see a little bit more positive sentiment out there. It remains tough. You know, we need job creation in South Africa. We need the economy to get kickstart. But definitely we can feel that there's a bit of a more positive sentiment out there. And we're excited and we are bullish, you know, about our future.
All right. Well, keeping South Africa warm at night, Chris de Wit, Chief Executive Officer, Home Choice. Thank you very much for talking to me today. And that's our program for today. We are back tomorrow with another 30 minutes looking at issues driving South Africa's business, political and social environment. Thank you for listening and goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at midday or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify, or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.